go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
I'm Ben. We are joined with our super producer, Ramsey Yunt, and I might as well go public with it, Scott. I think I may have mentioned it on the air earlier in a previous episode, but I'm not sure. You and I talked about this outside of the studio. I'm starting to look around for a new car.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. How's the search going?
It's going pretty well. I am, you know, the sweet spot, as you've always told me, for buying a car that is quote-unquote new to me, is about 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, that's right. That's a smart place to look, I guess. That sweet spot, that's where you find that most of the depreciation has already happened for a new car, and the price is down to an affordable rate. It's usually still below 100,000 miles, typically, hopefully it is.
Yeah.
You've got relatively, you know, a big market to choose from with that type of, you know, that criteria in mind, I guess.
So I, with the best of intentions, did something that may have stirred the pot a little bit on the internet. I went on to some social media and I said, I'm going to start looking for a new car, right? No timeline, nothing, no specific commitment. And I asked people what they like about the cars they have, right? Or if there were any specific makes or models that they would recommend avoiding. And
I bet you got a huge variety of responses, right?
Yep.
And which, to me, that would just, you know, confuse me more than anything, I think. I don't know. How do you find that this is working out for you so far? I mean, do you think it has confused you, or do you think that it is helping to refine your decision, like your narrow your search?
Yeah. Well, we're very much in the early days, right?
Yeah, sure.
And what I'm finding is that the same thing about every sort of piece of advice still holds true, and that is the following. People love giving advice that they don't have to take.
that's universally true.
Right. And a lot of my buddies who are car guys are very specific in their offers. One guy told me for $2,300, straight cash, straight scratch, I could get an RV camper.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Or he also tried to pitch me on a dump truck, and he said, it's in good condition except for the driver's seat.
Now, who is trying to sell you a dump truck as a daily driver? Because this is your bread and butter wagon, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
Getting to work and home from work. So you're going to drive a dump truck or an RV. I don't think so. But you know what? That's somebody who knows your interests, your likes, right? Because you like an RV. You've always liked an RV. You've always wanted to live in a van.
Glenn Beck was actually one of the first people who responded and asked me about, I think Glenn checked me on this, but I'm pretty sure Glenn asked me about a Winnebago.
Is that right?
Yeah, if you want, toward the end of this episode, I can pull some of this stuff up and read you the recommendations.
Oh, sure. Yeah, let's see what some of your friends have come across for you. See if they are true good friends or if they're just kind of feeding you a line. See if you'll do it. You know, this could almost be like a fun thing for people. Like, let's see if we can get Ben to buy a sports car, or let's see if we can get him to buy a pickup truck or whatever it is. Right.
And I would, you know, honestly, I would love a decent truck for sure.
Yeah.
But the thing that came up in my search and a little bit when people were talking about what sort of car to buy is the idea of affordability and its correlation to commonality. So remember when we did some episodes on the world's most stolen cars and the world's most common cars. I think they're still Honda Civics, right?
I think that's still the case, yeah.
Yeah. And Honda Civics are workhorses. Yeah. And I don't know if it's the same where in your neck of the global woods, friends and neighbors, but Scott and Ramsey and I can't walk more than about, or can't drive, we can't walk more than 500 yards, we can't drive more than 2 miles without seeing at least 3 Honda Civics.
Oh, that's probably true, yeah. Or Honda Accords or whatever mm-hmm. that happens to be. Even Ford F-150s. You know, pickup trucks are big down here in the South, and they make a lot of Ford F-150s and you know, their top-selling truck, of course, for many, many years, decades running.
Yeah.
So we see a lot of those around. But, yeah, those are the ones that end up being stolen the most because they are the ones that are most – well, I guess the most valuable for their parts. So
right.
they're stolen, stripped, and then sold as parts, you know, individual parts to people that want those parts for more money than, you know, the car itself is worth as a whole. So that's the reasoning behind that. And you're right about, you know, something is not quite as common. You know, something's a little more sought after, a little mm-hmm. bit more rare. Mm-hmm. It tends to be a little bit more valuable, but that's not always the case. And we'll talk about, you know, what it means to be a true rare car in just a minute. But I wanted to share with you one thing before we get started. And I know we've already gotten off to a different start here, not our topic as we always do, right?
Right,
but,
right.
I had something that had come across my desktop. You know, I think it was about a week ago, and I just didn't get a chance to read it on air. So it's a couple of weeks old now at this point, but it is a significant milestone for a manufacturer that I think we need to talk about. And this would go to the category of definitely not rare at this point. This is something that's the opposite of rare, as a matter of fact.
Oh wow!
Honda Motor Company, or Honda, you know, Honda, I guess motorcycles really, has produced its 100 millionth Super Cub. Now, the Super Cub is, if you're not familiar with it, because a lot of people here in the United States might not be, it is a moped, really. It's mm-hmm. And it always has been a moped. And if you look at the picture of, you know, a 1958 Honda Super Cub and a, you know, 2017 Super Cub, here in this article here, I've got a picture of them side by side, and they look like the same bike still. I mean, that's pretty remarkable for, you know, this being that many years on.
Yeah, not much has changed.
But, I mean, this is incredible. I mean, they introduced this thing back in, what, 1958, I said. And, you know, the company was founded in 1946.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a pretty young company at the time. And I think they said in this article that again, this comes from Car and Driver, I should say. So if anybody wants to look at it, follow along. They were just starting to make their first, you know, tentative runs at the Isle of Man TT back mm-hmm. then. They were also starting to really get serious about making this an alternate form of transportation for the people of Japan because, like, I think it was about 10 years prior to that, Vespa and Lambretta scooters were really, really popular. Of course, those are the Italian marks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had a unique, distinct body style that had, you know, like the knee shield and all that. Well, this one has a knee shield. It's a lot smaller than you'll find on a Vespa, but it's a little bit more of an upright bike, more of a bicycle-looking thing.
Yeah.
Everybody can picture what a classic moped looks like, and that's
sure.
similar to what this looks like. But the thing is, they added larger wheels and increased stability.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had something that was really unique at the time. Instead of going with a two-cycle engine like the Lambrettas and the Vespas, they went with a four-stroke engine. And that was like it's a tick in the pro box for a lot of people, you know, because
oh, yeah.
the two cycles that you had to mix the oil with all the time, and it was just kind of messy and smelly. And these were it was just a better engine. It was a bulletproof engine, as they said. It did come to the United States eventually, you know, not long after that. But they had to sell it as something called the Honda 50 because Piper had already used the Super Cub name for the airplane that it was building at the time. And I think a lot of people can remember the Piper Super Cub. They might even mm-hmm. still make that. I don't know. But anyways, this 100 millionth marker here is a big deal. I mean, when you think about it, you know, a run over that many decades, you know, that's a lot of vehicles. But I'll tell you some numbers in just a minute that should astound you, really. Mm-hmm. It should astound anybody, really, for production. But we've talked about, you know, the most common cars that, you know, here in the United States, you know, Volkswagen. I think we talked about Volkswagen Beetles, right?
Yeah.
They made
oh, yeah.
21.5 million of those. Over, you know, I don't remember how long that run was, but it was a long, long time. And of course, you know, the Model Ts, they made 15 million of those.
Right.
All right. So What's the other thing? The original Mini design. Remember the original Mini? Before BMW?
The good one?
The version? The original good one. The really tiny one, right?
Yeah, the actual Mini one.
We like all Minis, but yeah, the actual Mini one, yeah. They only made 5.4 million of those. And I say only, that's a huge number, right?
Sure.
But this is 100 million of these scooters. And so just even, and here's where it gets even more interesting, I think, anyways. Mm. All right, you know, they started in 1958 building these, so that's a long, long ramp up, right? But it turns out they weren't making as many back then, of course, because they're more popular now. You know, population density, it's even more important now that they build more. So I know that's a confusing way to say that, but the production has ramped up considerably, right?
Yeah.
So you got to remember that they only built their 20 millionth Super Cub in 1992. So that means that they've built 80 million of those bikes in the past 25 years.
That's insane.
80 million in 25 years out of that 100 million. And then if you want to go even more than that,
sure.
40 million of those 80 million were built since 2009. That's just 8 years ago.
So this is a definite hard curve for production.
Absolutely. And I kind of ran the numbers through a little bit of a filter here to figure out how many this means, really. And if you average all this out, so 8 years, 40 million bikes, right?
Mm-hmm.
That averages about 5 million per year. That means that every single day, this factory has averaged a production of about 13,699 Honda Cubs.
Holy smokes.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
14,000 a day.
Why don't we have any?
That's if they're cranking out 7 days a week and 365 days a year for the last 40 years or whatever it is.
Yeah, but what? That's the question that a lot of people are going to have. Like, if there are 100 million, mm-hmm. right, and if production is ramping up and has been ramping up over the years, especially recent years, why don't we see more of these in the U.S. and Honda hasn't sold the Super Cub, I believe, in the States for some time.
No, not for many years. They haven't sold it here. But they had a small run that came over here for a while.
Yeah.
And they were, they're popular, of course, but, sure. But worldwide, we see mopeds and small motorcycles as transportation for entire families sometimes.
Would you would you have a moped as your daily driver?
No, because the area that we live in is just far too congested.
Mm-hmm.
If it was a little bit more open, I would. Now, I know that these are great for areas that are congested, but typically they're congested with other similar traffic. There's a lot of people on mopeds, a lot of people on motorcycles. But when you mix the type of traffic that we have here in Atlanta with a moped, it doesn't really work out so well.
Right. And if I'm correct, you cannot drive a moped on the interstate.
That's right. Yeah, because there's a cc limit mm-hmm. To the engine size that restricts you from riding something like that there. Now, I think there's some bigger bikes that are considered, I don't know if they still are considered mopeds or not, but they have motorcycle-like speeds.
Yeah.
But they're still called, I think they're called scooters, not mopeds, and maybe that's the difference. There's some big scooters that can do it. But I don't think I would trust it, little 9-10-inch wheels on the highway. It just doesn't seem like it's a smart move.
I got to be honest with you, Scott. Usually in Atlanta, if I see someone in a scooter or moped, call it what you will, I assume that they have, for lack of a better term, I assume they have like real transport as also, I assume that they have a car in their garage.
Yeah.
Just because Atlanta has such sprawl and we're so reliant on very high speed transit passageways, mm-hmm. whether that's a three lane on either side road or whether that's an interstate, I don't see a scooter being a viable thing here, but I understand, especially in very densely populated cities where every single vehicle is probably going to be able to go about 15 miles an hour, mm-hmm. regardless of capability.
Yeah.
Engine-wise,
I could
see a scooter working really well.
Well, there are also a lot of hills here in Atlanta, so the entire city is built. Of course, it's not mountainous, but mm-hmm. but close to it. It's hilly, and you get behind a moped that's traveling at 20 miles an hour, and then it slows down to 15 or even 10 going up a hill.
Yeah,
depending on the year.
So you have to wonder, Scott. You got to wonder. Do we know if anyone has purchased the 100th millionth car or Cub, rather?
I don't know. I would think that Honda would you know, store that away somewhere, you know, like put it in a factory, not a factory, in a museum, the factory museum or whatever, you know, display it somewhere there on the grounds maybe.
You're being very Indiana Jones about this.
Well,
it belongs in a museum.
I guess I am, but, you know, it seems like they usually pull those out of production and label it. I mean, maybe it could be a giveaway to somebody or something, you know, as as a prize or something like that.
Or
I don't
like
know.
A retirement present, you know, instead of a watch.
Oh, that'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that would be super cool.
Probably, but would it be valuable, though, I wonder? I mean, because here's a situation where, you know, they've got 100 million of them, and they all basically look the same. I mean, look at the old ones and the new ones. They're pretty close. I mean, you can tell the new versus old, but it's really minor.
The new ones have two rearview mirrors.
There's a little bit more than that, but not much, really. I mean, you can tell it's an antique, but I think this is a case, Ben, maybe where because there are so many, I just don't think that the value of this particular product is going to be very high. I know that, you know, there might be some sought after specific models from specific years, but
sure.
I just don't think that with 100 million of them out there, they're ever going to be a rare find.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. That reminds me.
What?
Today's episode is about the world's rarest cars, and we'll get to it after a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Scott, I have to give you a solid apology there. I think that's the first time that we got to a commercial break without touching on the episode that we were supposed to do.
You may be right, Ben. I think maybe we got close last time, but you know, we often throw in a couple little extra I wouldn't call them Easter eggs, would you? No, they're not Easter eggs. You're not having to find them. You're not having to hunt for them.
Well, we have a lot of stuff going on.
It's a bonus for our listeners, I think. I hope they see it that way.
Yeah, write into our complaint department if you disagree. That's jonathan.strickland@howstuffworks.com and request your free Super Cub from him as compensation.
I wonder how long we're going to be able to get away with this.
Oh, man. He is out there 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, waiting to hear your complaints. And we cannot thank him enough for the work he does as Car Stuff's complaint department.
Tireless.
He's so mad.
Tireless at me. Servant. All right.
So we have we know that there is an embarrassment of riches in the automotive world now. Mm-hmm. And obviously not all cars are created equally. Not all cars are going to be as commonplace, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some are very hard to find.
Sure.
And I think that this list has to include cars. Now, there's going to be those cars that have gone extinct, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Those we can't include because it has to be a car that is around that can be, you know, can transfer hands, can be sold.
Sure.
Because the list that we're going by today, by the way, is from a place called Sheer Comfort Blog. And it's a good list. It really is. It's a list of the rarest cars, and not all these cars, as you'll find, are rare in that, you know, maybe they weren't the only ones produced, and we'll talk about that when we get to it, because there are a few caveats for certain model years and option packages, I guess, for certain vehicles.
Yeah, there's some fine print.
Yeah, a little bit. But all of these cars that we have on our list today will be, you know, valuable in some way. They're not extinct, as we said. You know, there has to be at least one existing in the world for it to count on this list.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the list is a good list. It covers 100 years of automotive history. It's from 1905. That's our earliest vehicle, all the way up through 2005. So, you know, ponder that for just a moment and think what could be so valuable, so rare from 2005 that might warrant a list on or a place on this list.
Right. And bonus points if you happen to predict one of the vehicles. No cheating. But if you can predict one, I would love to hear it. And of course, whenever we have a list like this, there are going to be things that Scott and I feel like should have also been included,
mm-hmm.
you know. So number 10, let's just start off with the beautiful 1957 Jaguar XKSS.
Yeah, that's right. Now, these were sold for about $5,000 in the 1950s. And if I went ahead, I went ahead and did this this price comparison. So 1957.
Sure.
If they were $5,000 at the time, that equates to only about $45,000 in 2017. I say only because that's a relatively low price for what we're looking at here.
Mm-hmm.
This is a car. There were only 16 of these cars ever built. So that's why it gets on this list. That's why it's number 10 on this list. And the idea behind them was that this was going to be made from the D-type Jaguars that were that they couldn't sell, the unsold D-types. They took 29 unsold D-types in the 1950s, and they were going to create them or build them into these road-going sports cars. And that's exactly what they did. And it was pretty easy to modify a D-type into a type into an XKSS, I should say. It took about 3 days for the factory to do the process, the makeover. And there's not a lot of these around because they were supposed to have 20. They're supposed to be 29.
Mm-hmm.
They had a fire at the factory that destroyed the ones that were remaining. So the 16 that made it out of the factory are the only surviving cars. The other, that'd be 13 that were left behind that were destroyed in this fire. So anyways, it's a rare vehicle, of course. Now, someone who owned one of these that we have seen at auction recently is Steve McQueen. Steve McQueen, he had a lot of different vehicles, drove a lot of different cars and motorcycles. And, a lot of those were very valuable, not only because of, who owned them, but because of the rarity. And he had, one of these XKSS vehicles, and it sold for about $30 million. Last time I was at auction. So hefty price tag on that one, but it's a great car. It's got a 3.4-liter racing engine with about 250 horsepower. It has incredible sleek looks. I mean, it's just a typical British racing car, really. I mean, that's what it is. It's for the road, a racing car for the road, really.
Yeah. And every time I hear these sorts of lists, I always start kicking myself, because neither of us were out buying cars in 1957.
No.
But can you imagine, just putting the equivalent of $45,000 at the time into this car? You could have just parked it and taken it out on the weekends, done the scheduled maintenance, and then boom, you'd be sitting on $30 million.
Yeah, I know. It's huge, isn't it? Now, there's a couple of cars later in this list that we're going to talk about that, it came down to, putting a check mark in the right box on the factory options to make it more valuable. But who knew at the time? I mean, it just ends up that, only a few people did it for a certain year, and that's what makes it super valuable. So when we get to those, we'll let you know. But another one that's a rarity is the 1948 to 1950 Aston Martin 2-liter Sports DB1.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
The DB1, the first of its kind. And it was named after Sir David Brown, who was the owner of a tractor manufacturing company, who purchased Aston Martin in 1947. So just after he made the purchase, he was the owner of the company. They named a vehicle after him, the DB in DB1 stands for David Brown.
There we go.
Of course, there were very few of these built as well, only 15 mm-hmm. that ever came from the factory. The car was only manufactured for about 2 years, from 1948 to 1950, as we said. And, of these 15 cars, of course, there's very few of them around, and they don't often come up at auction. They don't often trade hands. In fact, the one that recently that did come up for auction, it was sold in really poor condition. It wasn't in good shape. So in poor condition, these things are worth about $120,000 at this point. So again, if you ever see an Aston Martin DB1, pay special attention because you're seeing something unique.
It's probably the one time – honestly, it's probably the one time you'll see it.
Probably, yeah. I mean, unless it's at your local museum that you go to often, and you'll see the same one again. But yeah, to see more than one of these in your lifetime – I don't know. I mean, maybe that's rare. Maybe someone has two or three of them. Who knows? People kind of do that with cars. They find one mark that they really like, and then they have, two of the remaining five or, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
So we find that with Tucker cars a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Now, there are only 51 Tucker vehicles built, mm-hmm. and I think a couple of those have been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So, even more rare to see them now. But we see, when we go to museums, we see a couple on display or, an engine display where they have six engines.
Right.
Things like that. People tend to collect or to gather as many bits of you know, Tucker memorabilia that they can, you know, sure. whether it's the his drafting board or, you know, the door from the barn where he worked or whatever it was, remember?
These are all true stories, by the way.
Yeah.
In the Automotive Museum up there in Hershey, Pennsylvania, you will see the barn door that Tucker used.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yep, the AACA Museum, I think it is, yeah. All right, number eight on our list. Let's move on here. 1948 to 1951, Talbot Lago T-26 Grand Sport.
Which is a very unusual-looking car. So there were only 12 of these manufactured, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And it's one of the most powerful cars in the world because it has a 4.5-liter six-cylinder engine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And top speed, 125 miles an hour. It won the Le Mans in 1950.
Oh, and one other thing that I think we need to mention about this car's history before we move on to talk about the price of this thing, because it is expensive. We should say that, that this company was bought by Simca in 1958, and so the Grand Sport's rarity is only amplified because it was one of the last cars that was produced by that company. So, you know what? We should also say one other thing is that Simca was then later bought by Chrysler Europe in 1970. So, you know, pushing it even further down the line that, you know, this thing is never going to be reproduced again. This rare car, so it's what 12 manufactured, I think we said?
Sure, yeah.
An estimated $2.5 million for this car. Now, when you look at it, it's a beautiful car, but I don't know if it's $2.5 million beautiful. Again, but how can you assign dollars to, you know, the way a car looks? It's pretty. I mean, it's a nice-looking vehicle. At least the one in the photo here is that we're looking at.
You know,
I don't know what the other 11 look like.
And being in the market for a new car, you know, I'm yeah, keeping my options open.
Yeah, I understand. You know, I mean, it is gorgeous, but, you know, I always have a hard time with this, Ben. Like, is that what makes this one worth $2.5 million? And, you know, the one that we just looked at previously, what makes that one only worth, you know, $120,000 in poor shape? I mean, it's probably worth $1 million in good shape or whatever.
Supply and demand, my friend.
I guess so. I mean, yeah, supply and demand. So this one with only 12 versus the other one that only had 15, right?
Well, what do you think about number seven on our list, which is the 1971 Plymouth Hemi CUDA convertible?
Mm-hmm. Okay, now convertible is what makes this one unique. It's not that it's anything dramatically different from anything that they were producing in 1971, but someone checked the convertible box on this one, and it's a Hemi CUDA, so that makes it even more valuable. Now, only 11 of these were built, right? So it's pretty rare.
And this is a muscle car. There aren't many bells and whistles.
No, you know. I mean, and a Hemi-powered CUDA is always a desirable vehicle, of course.
Sure.
But again, the fact that it's a convertible is what makes this one unique, with this one different. So these will occasionally come up in at auction. You know, they trade hands regularly, I would say. I don't know about that often, but you'll see them here and there. And when they do come up for auction, people know. They know to go there and to kind of stake it out and see which one it is, and they know who's owned it before, so they know the whole history of the vehicle. In January of 2013, one of these went for $1.32 million at the Barrett Jackson Scottsdale auction. However, later, just 1 year later, at the Mecum auction, a different CUDA was sold for an even higher amount. There was an 8-minute bidding war on this vehicle, and it went for $3.2 million. $3.2 million.
Pretty crazy.
That's pretty crazy, yeah.
For a muscle car.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really high. I mean, I thought when we were, when we first started this show, you know, a while back, 9 years ago or something like that now?
Oh, man.
We were seeing some incredible prices for muscle cars on these auction circuits, and they were still in the, you know, $250,000 range, you know, maybe a little bit more even.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're getting up into $3.2 million for a Hemi CUDA convertible. That's a lot of cash for something like that. I don't know. I mean, is it one that's so dramatically different from everything else that you have to have it? I mean, I don't know. I don't know where to file this one away to. I mean,
yeah.
It's not a supercar. It's not like there are no other Hemi powered CUDAs built. It's just there's only 11 CUDA convertibles that were built that year, and that's what makes it valuable. So again, someone checked the box, the $600 option or whatever it was, made it, you know, 10,000 times more valuable. Whatever that is.
Which also makes me wonder, you know, if you're buying a new car, should you just go for a weird trim package? Should you just assemble this compilation of your own very specific options and upgrades and then later learn that you're one of 12 people who did so?
Oh, that's a smart move. You know, I think that for a while when you could order a new Dodge Viper, you could order all kinds of different custom paint and appearance packages. And I think – I'm not entirely sure, but I think it would tell you how many people have ordered the same thing that you have. And you could change it in some way to make it unique. And I would be willing to bet that someone's going to have, you know, a one-of-a-kind Dodge Viper from a certain year that someday is going to be worth a lot of money because of that, because they selected stuff that, I mean, maybe no one else wanted. Maybe that was it.
Yeah.
And if everybody wants it, it's not going to be as valuable. Now, here's one that probably a lot of people would have wanted. That,
I'm very excited about this one.
Are you really? All right.
It's the oldest one.
So what is this one? This is our earliest entry, I guess.
The 1905 Rolls-Royce 15 HP.
Mm-hmm. 15 HP standing for?
Horsepower.
15 horsepower, yeah. And when you look at this vehicle, it's a big vehicle, right? Big open top, what would you call it? It's like a carriage, I guess, almost. You know, like the horse's carriage look, right?
Yeah, it's a salon body style, two doors. It's very, very old vehicle, and quite frankly, this is a museum piece.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And there, make no bones about it. It's the second oldest surviving Rolls-Royce in the world, and in addition, it's one of the rarest cars that Rolls-Royce ever made.
Yeah, there were six of these built total, and currently only one exists. There's only one around today. So this one is, of course, extremely valuable. Top speed is only somewhere around 39 miles per hour on this vehicle. We're laughing at it, but it's a beautiful car. It's nice. I mean, I like it. It's green. It's an unusual look. Of course, you don't see this type of vehicle anywhere today except in a museum, as you said, Ben. It's rare to see something like this even at, you know, some of the top-end auto shows that we see.
Sure.
Not auto shows, but maybe
auctions.
Auctions and even, you know, like the kind of events where people all pull into a parking lot and, you know, show off what they've got. But this
right.
one wouldn't be this one is probably a car that tours.
Yeah, there's a little more Pebble Beach, I think, than
yeah.
your local car show.
Yeah, you know what? That's probably the better way to say it, is that, you know, you'd be more apt to see something like this at a concours event than you would be at, you know, the Cars and Caffeine that we see sometimes. So they really don't have a price tag on this vehicle. I mean, it's a super rare vintage car, but they have appraised, you know, they do this often, they appraise it for insurance recovery costs if anything were ever happened to it. And the estimated value of this Rolls-Royce is about $35 million.
Yeah.
$35 million. Unbelievable. But again, one of a kind right now, and one of only six ever built. I wonder what happened to those six. What's the story with the other five, you know?
Is there just some guy who has the other five?
No.
And isn't telling anyone?
I feel like, I mean, not this isn't the case every time, but it seems like they have pretty good records of what happens, like, you know, or what happened. Like maybe, you know, this one's gone through two world wars. So maybe, you know, it was a war casualty. Maybe it was lost during a bombing raid or something
right.
like that. A lot of times that you'll find that'll happen, especially with some of the European marks that were around, you know, around that time. Just unfortunate side effect. Along with many others.
Yeah.
Number five on our list.
Mm-hmm.
This one you'll like.
Yes.
Maybe.
Yes.
Maybe.
You know.
Well, I do, but is this the body style that you like? I mean, we're talking about a Packard.
Right.
A 1954 Packard Panther Daytona Roadster.
Yeah, this is a beautiful little machine. It's a two-seater, and only four were ever built. It was originally called the Grey Wolf II, but Packard thought it was best to go with the name Panther because they wanted to commemorate the Packard racer who was active from 1903 to 04. And the design of it, as like a concept car thing, I'm really interested in the body of the vehicle as well, and I'm glad you brought this up. It is entirely made of fiberglass. It's
yeah.
one piece fiberglass body.
Pretty strange, huh? But I guess, you know, if you go along with what Chevrolet was doing with the Corvette at the time, fiberglass was starting to become an option for automakers, and they were kind of playing around with what they could do with it. And to make this this vehicle fiberglass, it's pretty astounding, you know, considering what, you know, the history of Packard, you know, because they were always a big, solid metal vehicle, you know, really
right.
sturdy. I mean, not to say that this one isn't sturdy, but it's just something completely out of the ordinary for Packard, really.
Was so much experimentation with automobiles, mm-hmm. right? And in material science, mm-hmm. yeah, and even just design and conceptual stuff. In the 1950s, there was this real – I don't want to ding the 2017 automotive market, but – In the 50s, man, there was this real golden age of manufacturers going, yeah, let's try it. Let's, you know what? Just put some more chrome on it. Put a dome on it. Yeah. Who needs an orthodox hood?
Gigantic fins and lots of chrome accents on the side and all that, and a big white wall. So this one's got giant white walls, of course.
Yeah.
Lots of chrome and those protruding front bumpers. It's a neat looking vehicle. So if you get a chance, look up the 1954 Packard Panther Daytona Roadster. And this one had a straight 8 engine and had a 2-speed transmission, which I thought was a little bit unusual, but an automatic 2-speed. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that's strange to me. I would think that 3-speed was kind of like the starting point for something like this.
Yeah.
In that era, I should say, maybe. But it had a 212 horsepower. It had 212 horsepower and a top speed of 131 miles per hour. So it was no slouch. I mean, it was a quick car. I bet that lightweight body helped out quite a bit.
Here's one of my questions. This is a concept car, right, Scott?
Yeah, it is.
Okay. So this is a concept car that won the lottery of ideation and became like technically, with a boatload of caveats, a production car, sort of?
Well, they made four, so I guess. I mean,
is that enough, though?
Well,
I mean, it's not like the race car numbers, right?
No, but it did come off the assembly line.
That is true.
And so that stands for sort of that,
yeah.
That proves something, I guess, is that, it wasn't just built in some design studio somewhere.
It did sell. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, Scott, Ben, super producer Ramsey, I'm in. How much? How much cheddar is this going to – how much cheddar do I need to grate?
For one of the four?
For
one of these four, about $825,000 was the last price that was seen at auction. So it's pretty expensive. But again, to have one of four that exist, that's pretty good.
And what price can you put on history?
That's right, yeah. But, I mean, we'll be back after a word from our sponsor with the rest of our list.
We have returned, and now we are in we're in the era where I'm kicking myself again. I wasn't buying cars in 1967 and 1970 specifically. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest with you. I got some regrets. I think I was born too late, maybe.
Is that right?
Yeah, because the 1967 and 1970 Dodge Coronet, specific type.
Yeah, the RT Hemi convertible. Mm-hmm. Those are the valuable ones. And what makes them valuable, you would think, well, okay, the Coronet is not particularly valuable on its own. It was
right.
not an uncommon vehicle. They built a lot of them.
Sure.
But again, because this is the RT Hemi version with the convertible option, that's what makes it valuable. They only built two of these in 1967 and two of them in 1970. So that's it. So, when these things come up for auction, people take notice again. Now, it has to be, factory original.
Right.
It has to be the ones from the factory. But again, these are the ones that people watch and kind of track, and they know the history of it. They know who's owned it before. They know all the history behind it. They know everything about it. So when it's coming up for auction, people get excited about it. Now, this one isn't quite as valuable as some of the other cars. I mean,
yeah, it's not the Jaguar. It's not the Aston Martin, but
yeah, it's not in the $1 million range.
No. It's, should we tell everyone?
Sure.
We're looking at around $150,000 the last few times it was, in an auction.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that in this case, similar to the CUDA, in this case, it is entirely due to the rarity of the vehicle. And that's what makes it stick out. It's sort of a diamond in the rough of the entire production. line of coronets.
Yeah, which is odd because, again, it's just a trim package that somebody – not a trim package, but an option that somebody selected, you know, in 1967, 1970. Only four people total checked those boxes, and that's what made it valuable. That's what made it stand out from all of the other production coronets that were happening at the time. Of course, you know, the Hemi option, that's big, of course. That was a popular engine at the time. This one, by the way, the 1970 model anyways, is a lot more powerful with 425 horsepower for that engine.
Yeah.
Pretty strong. So that's a performer as well. But again, it's just one of those things that, you know, it's kind of an oddball vehicle on this list, but it still has a place on the list because it is a rare vehicle.
Sure.
But it's not a supercar. It's not, you know, made from some manufacturer with a long storied history that, you know, well, I guess, you know, Chrysler has a great history. It's just, it doesn't have the history maybe that, or the richness of history that like Morgan or Jaguar or Aston Martin or any of those other brands have. Just a different one. That's just different history.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's strange. I mean, it's just an oddball on the list, I think. That's probably the best way. That and the other one, the Hemi Cuda convertible.
Yeah.
I find that those two were kind of a strange fit. Now, the next one is a concept car. So this one, I can kind of see this one being on the list. Again, a concept car from 1954. Mm-hmm. It's the Oldsmobile F88. And, of course, it was made by General Motors and, you know, General Motors Oldsmobile. If Oldsmobile was still around, we would have to do a story on Oldsmobile history.
Have we
maybe
not done a story on Oldsmobile?
I don't think we have. I know we've included the history in other podcasts that we've done, but we've never done an Oldsmobile history series.
Let's do it because, you know, I drove a bunch of those.
I know you did, yeah. Which ones were that? It was the Chiva?
Yeah.
That was one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that a rare car?
Well,
it probably is now.
I would be very surprised if someone found it now. It, you know, I felt like, you know how the military service members will have the, this is my rifle. There are others like it, but this is mine.
Mm-hmm.
It was my very first car was an Achieva.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And I got in a tangle with a school bus. Did I ever tell you that?
Yes, you did. That's the car. Huh?
That was the car. So it's, while Achievas in general may not be rare, nor, if we're being candid, particularly spectacular. Mm-hmm. In my case, this is a very rare car. I would be very surprised if someone managed to dig it up after what I did. I was just a garbage driver, man.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? I would wonder the last time that I've seen an Achieva on the road. It has been a while. And I bet there's somewhere in town where a lot of people see somebody who commutes in one or something, you know, and it's like, oh, I see that every day. That's
you
not
think
a big
they're
deal.
Still a daily driver?
Oh, there have to be. There have to be.
Maybe.
I think for most of those cars, you know, where they produced, you know, 100,000, 500,000, whatever
sure,
sure. it is, I think there still have to be plenty of examples out there. It's just, you know, we don't see them where we are in our little, you know, our little bubble, our area here. Yeah.
Now, we're a family show, so I'm not going to go too deep into this story, but I think everybody's first car is this huge milestone. And I got in my first car chase in that car. This is unrelated to the school bus incident.
Car chase?
Yeah, man, with a bully. He was in like 12th grade.
Oh, okay. I was thinking police chase.
No.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. A bully. I'll keep it short. Check me if this is too lewd for a family show.
Sure.
But hey, let's see. I'm trying to think of the best way to say it. So this guy was a bully, and I was the first kid out of our friend group who was able to drive, right? Mm-hmm. And I had my neighborhood buddies – you know, all my childhood high school friends, we would take my car to school, back from school, you know. And one day, this guy who was just in retrospect, Scott, the nicest thing I can say is I guess he was trying to figure out who he thought he was.
Okay.
And
it's a fair way to put it.
Yeah. And he had he was having a senior party, graduation party kind of thing at his house. And so he thought it would be a good idea to go in the buff, to go naked and hold a sign about his party over his junk as people were getting out of school. Yeah, 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 yeah. So and there was this one gas station where everybody went after school, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Right down the street.
Okay.
So we go down the street, and this guy had a Jeep, and here's how brilliant he was. He left his clothes in the Jeep that was just parked, and this is open air, you know.
Yeah.
He didn't have it zipped up or anything. And so we stole his clothes and drove by, you know, we're like honking, giving him the finger. And so then he runs back into the Jeep, and so we were in this car chase.
You're being chased by a nude guy in a Jeep.
Yeah, and thank God no one got hurt.
Oh, my God. What a story. This is like a variation on the old swimming hole story, you know, like where people are swimming, you know, naked. They're in the buff there, and they've got the clothes that they've thrown off the side, and someone nabs the clothes, kind of laughs at them, right?
Yeah.
But this is right in the middle of town.
I have no regrets. He was not a cool dude. And as he was chasing us, thank God it was a Jeep because, you know, you can't do the corners very well on a Jeep at high speeds. Right?
Sure, sure.
And so we went into this really rickety, hilly neighborhood to try to lose the guy. Mm-hmm. And he was very committed to, you know, trying to find us.
No, sure.
And so we were like throwing his clothes out the car at him.
Oh, no.
Anyway, I've gotten very derailed.
Well, okay. One last thing on this, though. I need to know.
All right.
It's a relatively small town, right?
Yeah.
Was there hell to pay later for you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was.
All right. Well, that's all I needed to know. All right. So back to our list. That was a good story.
Back to our show, our actual what we're supposed to be
all right. doing. I think we were talking about the 1954 Oldsmobile F88. It's a GM concept car. Mm-hmm. And again, this is one of those concept cars that made it into that kind of semi-production gray area, right? Because there were four built in a 1954, as we said. Only one of these exists today.
Yeah, it was a pet project of Harley Earl, whom you will remember, longtime listeners, from our early episodes, right? Earlier episodes.
Yeah, we've talked about Harley Earl many times.
And we've seen some of his work in person.
Oh, yeah, we have. We went to the I forget the name of that museum. Or not the museum, but it's the High Museum of Art here in Atlanta. I can't remember the name of it. It was like car design, the art of the design or something like that.
Art
of the car or something like that. Beautiful exhibit. And Harley Earl's products were on display there. This one, however, was not there. It's, again, one of a kind. It was a concept vehicle that sort of made it into production. As we said, there were four built, which is kind of strange, but they did come from the factory. Mm. And that's what makes it that alone makes it kind of a rarity. I mean, that didn't happen all that often. You said it was from Harley Earl. It had a 5.3-liter Super 88 V8 engine that had 250 horsepower, which is pretty cool. Now, it's a two-door roadster-style car.
Right.
And one went up for auction in 2005. And,
the only one.
Yeah, the only one. This is the only one, I should say. The one went up for sale. It's a gold-colored vehicle, if you want to look up some photos of it. But 2005, this one sold for $3.3 million. $3.3 million. Get your hands on a one-of-a-kind Harley Earl pet project.
Makes you think maybe you should go with the Coronet, honestly.
Maybe. What was that? That was like 120,000 or something, right?
Yeah. Now, everybody.
150,000.
Yeah. I think everybody was expecting this. Everyone was expecting a Ferrari to show up at some point on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And that is number two on our list, the 1996 Ferrari F50 GT.
Yeah. This is a car that was actually going to compete in a road racing series. It was supposed to compete in something called the BPR Global GT Series. And unfortunately, this project was canceled because the rivals in that series, they were supposed to race against like Porsche and Mercedes. And the rivals kind of upped their game. And this car became inferior or, I guess, obsolete. They said, you know, we can't do this. We can't compete with this vehicle against what they've done, so we're going to have to change our game, you know, in the middle here. But they did make three of these. They made three of them ever. One was supposed to be just a prototype, and two were to be sold.
That's right, Scott. There are three, and the stats are pretty good. The specs are solid.
Yeah, really solid.
Yeah, 4.7-liter V12 engine, so we're talking 750 bhp, 2.9 seconds for 0 to 60.
2.9 seconds, and that was in 1996. That's 21 years ago. Can you believe that?
Wow.
21 years ago, 2.9 seconds. We're seeing stuff like that from McLaren now. Mm-hmm. You know, with their cars, but that's right now in 2017. And I know that there were other racing cars that could do that back then. I get that. You know, some that were probably even faster, I'm sure. you know, there had to be Formula One cars or something that were doing that. But this is a car that was meant to be sold to the public, and, you know, at least two of them anyways. The prototype, that was the one that I'm sure the factory probably was hanging on to that one. I would guess. I mean, it doesn't say here in the article. But the price on this thing in 2013, $2.9 million, which is they say it's pretty reasonable considering there are only three in the world, but 2.9, come on, that's still a lot of money. It's a beautiful car, though. I mean, take a look at the 96 Ferrari F50 GT and tell us what you think.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. But that's not the number one vehicle on our list.
May we have a drum roll, please? Ladies and gentlemen, Scott and I would like to introduce you to number one on our list, the 2005 Maybach Accelero.
Yeah, this is a definitely a unique vehicle. It's a one-of-a-kind vehicle that was built by the factory, of course. You know, these are oftentimes extremely luxurious vehicles.
Sure.
Very, very luxurious. Now, this one, Ben, we'll just let the cat out of the bag on this one right up front. This car from the factory was very, very expensive. $8 million is what this thing cost brand new. And that was back in 2005. Now, this is the newest vehicle on our list.
Yeah.
So 2005. So, again, we've covered 100 years in this list from 1905 to 2005. But, again, $8 million out of the factory. Now, the one car that they built, you might think, well, why would they build this one? Is it, you know, like a showpiece for somebody? Well, it kind of is. It was built as a one-of-a-kind supercar for a company called Fulda, which is a German tire company. And in 2005, it was, again, I don't know how this happened, but it became available for the public to purchase. So this car is available, and it's at, I guess, the Maybach factory in Germany. However, it has not sold as of right now. I think that right now, this car is still available. You could still buy it if you wanted to. And someone has tried in the past, right?
Yeah.
Someone tried to buy this one, but
right.
But didn't quite have the money that they thought they had.
Right. So the rapper... Well, okay. I wouldn't call him a rapper. Let's call him a producer. Birdman, also known as Baby Williams, tried to purchase the vehicle back in 2011, but didn't have the cash up front. So it's still the property of the European automaker. And at this point, if you're sitting around going, what do I do with this $8 million, guys? It's crowding up my house.
Yeah.
This might be an avenue you could pursue because you can buy it. You can literally buy it today. The Accelero, one of a kind, amazing specs.
Yeah. Really amazing. Now, it's a heavy car.
Yeah, it's almost 3 tons.
Yeah, it's 2.9 tons. It weighs, if you want to be specific about it, it weighs 5,863 pounds, which is a giant vehicle. But it does have a V12 twin turbo engine that has about 700 horsepower. And, oh my gosh, top speed, 218 miles per hour. Now, looking at the car, it's sleek, sure, but I wouldn't guess that's a 218 mile per hour car right there.
No, it doesn't look like it. It looks heavy.
It does look heavy. And the thing is, it goes from 0 to 62 in just 4.4 seconds. So 4.4 seconds is quick. It's not lightning quick like a supercar fast or a motorcycle fast.
Sure. You're still going to get waxed if you're racing that Ferrari.
I guess. Yeah, you're right. If you're racing that one Ferrari, right? So that'd be quite a matchup, wouldn't it? A couple of ultra rare cars on the highway, like just doing a little street racing.
I'd love to see that at a red light.
Oh,
you
my
know
God.
What
well,
I mean?
Yeah. What would the value of that race be? That would be, let's see, 2.9 for the Ferrari and then 8 for this. So an $11 million race. That's what that would be. Yeah, can you imagine moving nearly 3 tons to 60 miles per hour in 4.4 seconds? That's pretty strong. That's a powerful vehicle. And take a look at the photos of this one because, you know, again, it's out there. There's mm-hmm. studio shots of it. I don't know if you can find any production photos of it or not. I haven't even looked, but, I think it's kind of neat looking. It's not that much different from their great big luxury vehicles, only
sure.
that this is the sports car version of it, really.
Two things, though, before we close today's episode.
Mm-hmm.
First, I got to say, with this list, they included very interesting vehicles, but
yeah.
the world is so full of one-of-a-kind vehicles and extremely rare vehicles. you got to wonder what else would be on this list.
Yeah, you know, Ben, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of cars out there where there's only one built. And, you know, I was thinking of, you know, some other cars where there were a few built, but only a couple remain, you know, like where there's you know, the Steinway Mercedes. That was one. You remember Steinway, the piano manufacturer
that
built the body for the Mercedes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, cars like that, that, I can see where those are valuable. But, I mean, okay, the last one maybe is something that I wasn't expecting, is that, you know, there's only one of these built, and that's why it's so expensive. I understand, you know, that there's a lot put into this one, too. It's not just that it's just the only one of its kind. But you'd think that there could be some other way to kind of separate this list out to, you know, there were 100 of these cars made, and only three, you know, survived the fire, and, you know, only one exists today. That seems to be even more rare than the one where they just built one and it's been kind of under factory wraps for a while.
Right, you know? Yeah, that's a really good point.
I don't know how to put that. I mean, I'm really struggling with how a car can be called rare or classified as rare. Mm-hmm. Or more rare than another car. And I guess maybe that comes down to dollar amounts, like on our list here. I mean, because we're talking about an $8 million factory car.
Right.
But it was only built – well, there's only one built. Other cars on the list were more valuable, but there were more of them built.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really tough to put all this together in your head. Like what makes it the most valuable? I know there are some surprising examples missing from this list, but they only had 10 spots, and we hear that all the time when we do shows. I can't believe you didn't mention this, but you know, there are other lists that have different vehicles on them, so you'll find those with, you know, like the ZL1 Camaro, you know, that type of thing. Or again, someone just checked the right box in that year, that production year, and made it that much more valuable.
And how many one-of-a-kind cars are locked away in Jay Leno's Cave of Wonders?
Yeah, he's probably got a lot of them, right? I mean, there's probably a ton of those.
He's got he has a steam-powered car.
Yeah, sure.
That he knows how to operate and runs.
Probably has more than one, I would guess. I mean, you know, different types of steam-powered vehicles.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
He probably has one that's his favorite or one that, you know, is more valuable
than the daily rest. Driver.
Yeah, exactly. His daily driver.
So here's the second thing.
Okay.
Is the second thing.
Because I'm really in a corner here with this. This list has confounded me for a couple of days now, but we'll work on it later. we'll sort this out, maybe have a follow-up discussion or something.
Yeah, and we want your help, friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, sorry. I interrupted your second thing.
Oh, yes, because we set it up at the top of the show, and I talked about looking for a new car.
Oh, yeah.
Some of the responses I got. So Glenn Beck asked if I was still looking for a Winnebago.
Mm-hmm. Does Glenn have a Winnebago for sale, I wonder?
I think Glenn's just...
That sounds very specific, you know?
Yeah, I think he just knows how much I want one.
Yeah.
Or love the idea of one.
Yeah.
So I replied, after 8 years of heated debate, Scott finally talked me off that ledge. Also, maybe.
Clever.
So then people are recommending Hyundai. They said it was a boring car but reliable.
Sure.
It seems to be the consensus. And then I told you about the guy who wanted to sell me a dump truck.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, what was it, a dump truck? And then the other one was another RV, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also he has a lead on a low-mileage Caddy from 2005. We had somebody who said they love their RAV4, which I don't know if that's for me. I understand that people like them.
Yeah.
Well, that came off as though I hate them. I don't hate them. I just don't think
– It's just not for you.
They're my style. And then some people were saying to stay away from Nissan and four-cylinder Chevys.
Is that right?
Yeah. Hmm. And – specifically because they said four-cylinder Chevys, I had to chime in and say, all right, pump your brakes, buddy.
Yeah. Why?
Well, I'm not driving a four-cylinder, but I can't have people all over the internet being disrespectful to Chevys. No, I'm kidding.
I understand. You're a Chevy guy.
But
will that continue?
I don't know, man.
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean,
it'll be interesting to see what you end up with. I mean, you're getting some advice from people. I've never heard anything bad about, I should say never, but I don't know what's going on with, you know, people hating on Nissan. I'm not sure what that's all about. But and four-cylinder Chevys, it seems like there's plenty of decent four-cylinder Chevys, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I need to investigate this further.
People are going back and forth on Jeep, too.
Huh. Is that right?
Jeeps and... of course, somebody told me to just buy an A3 and an Audi, and I was not That's not going to happen.
Not having it, huh?
Yeah, okay. Not having it.
Solid car, though.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one of our other – of course, several people chimed in and said, just bite the bullet. Get a Ford F-150. Mm-hmm. Eventually, everyone will drive one of these.
Yeah, it seems that way, doesn't it?
It does.
It really does. There's a lot of them around here. I mean, a lot.
The roadways of tomorrow are going to be exclusively Honda Civics, Honda Accords, and F-150s.
Yeah, Nissan Leaf. You got to throw the Nissan Leaf in there.
You're throwing in the Leaf?
Well, there's a ton of them on the road here. I think – hey, didn't we – one time we did this, and I know we need to wrap up. We've gone long today, but it seems that – one time I found a list of state cars. You know, like you have a state bird, a state song, a state leaf, whatever, or state tree. Someone created this list of state cars, and it was done by the number of new car registrations in the state and the like the most predominant type of vehicle that was sold in that state. And I believe that for Georgia, I think it was the Nissan Leaf. I think it was.
No way.
Yeah, I can't remember every state, obviously, you know, with what that was, but what the vehicle was. But Nissan Leaf, I think, was the most registered vehicle, at least for that year. And this is going back a couple of years.
That's surprising.
Well, I don't know, Ben. I mean, I've been paying attention to how many Nissan Leafs I've seen on the road since then, and there are a ton of them. It seems like you can't sit at a stoplight without having, you know, one or two around you. So there's a ton of them here. Lots of them.
So I'm wondering then if maybe – maybe I'm not seeing them because I'm not looking for them. It's kind of – you know, there's a lot of psychology behind the cars that stick out to us on the road when we're driving. And this is easily proven in the case of any of your friends buying a car. Like if you buy, for instance, one of our coworkers bought a Honda Fit recently. And he is continually baffled and amazed and astonished by how many Honda Fits he sees on the road.
But he didn't see them prior to that.
No, of course not.
Yeah, he wasn't looking for them.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like when I see another Monte Carlo on the road, I think we're best friends.
Yeah.
I'm like waving to people.
This is that Bader-Meinhof thing, is that right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah, Bader-Meinhof.
Yeah, yeah, it's where if you get something stuck in your head or you've recently purchased something, you then see more of that around you or you focus on those more than you had in the past because it just was something that was that would pass you by and you wouldn't even notice it. Give it a second thought even. But
like you have a song stuck in your head and then you hear it later on the radio.
Yeah.
Right? Are you psychic or did you just notice it because you were already thinking about it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And before we delve into the psychology of how people notice cars, Scott, you and I have to get on the road. We both have some road trips ahead of us this weekend.
Yep.
And we'd love to hear from you. What do you think should be on this list of the world's rarest cars? Do you – just going to take a shot in the dark here, man – do you happen to own one of the cars on the list?
I bet a lot of people are going to claim to have, you know, a rare car. It's going to be like a Honda Civic, but mine has silver wheels, 10-spoke. You know, no one else has that. So, you know, I bet that's it. Well, with a sunroof.
What was that one you were telling me about earlier, where they just put crystals all over?
Oh, that was the Chrysler 300.
Yeah.
With the Swarovski crystals or whatever it was on every bit of trim and the door handles, the window surrounds, the grill, everywhere. I haven't seen that car again, so I'm wondering if it was not a state vehicle. But pretty unusual.
Yeah. So on a personal note, folks, please don't do that to your car. But it's your car. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like some dad talking to his kids about tattoos.
To each his own, right?
Yeah, yeah. But while you're under my roof. No, just kidding. All right, we got to get out of here. You can find Scott and I on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Twitter. You can write to us directly. Let us know your take on the world's rarest cars. And let us know specifically if you think there's another Ferrari that should have been included on this. Maybe even replace the one that's on the current list. Mm-hmm. You can write to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.